Hello, and welcome to Films That Time Forgot, a show where we look at overlooked Hollywood films from the early 1980s to the early 2010s and see whether they need a critical re-evaluation. I'm your host, Adam Thornton, and joining me today is Scott Murphy.
Thanks for having me on again, Adam.
Now, for any kind of first-time listeners, can you just remind them or let them know what you do?
What I do? I guess I do a couple of things. I guess my main thing is I host a podcast called All 90s Action all the time, where we look at we just look at 90s action movies and we discuss and review them and see how they've held up over these last 30 years. And we look at the corresponding year to the year that we're in. So this year is 2026, and so what we this year we're covering the films of 1996. That's kind of that one. I co-host that with a fellow podcaster, Craig Draheim. He's on a lot of the episodes, although sometimes it's just me and a guest when Craig can't make it. I used to host a podcast called New Horror Express, which ran for about 6 years. I no longer do that, but I interviewed horror film directors, writers, actors, all sorts of people, novelists involved in the world of independent horror. That, like I say, ran for 6 years. There's about 185 episodes, which are still all available on your favorite podcast providers. And my latest venture is a brand new podcast that just started at the end of last year. There's only two episodes available currently, and it's called Bloody Sam, a Peckinpah fan podcast. And that is, yeah, it's just exploring the films of Sam Peckinpah. It is kind of like it's not going to be a long-running series. It's just going to be like a mini series covering the 14 feature films of Sam Peckinpah's filmography. You're going to be a guest on that,
Oh,
and
yeah.
I guess this will come out at a similar time because that episode will come out at the end of February. Even though on the episode we recorded, I accidentally said the end of March on the episode you were on. Yes, that's the all the podcasts I have done
And
or am doing.
I'd recommend them, particularly the episode I'm guesting on. Is it? It's Major Dundee, isn't it? With
Yes, yes.
the dream team of Charlton Heston and Richard Harris, like oil and water.
Yes, not a team that you'd be expecting maybe, but yes, an interesting team all the same. And it's an to give a little spoiler, it is an interesting conversation, 'cause we came away with divergent points of view, and I think a lot of that was driven by the fact that we saw two different cuts of the same film. But I will say no more. I won't spoil the episode any further than that, but I will say that as a little spoiler for people.
Well, what I will say about Major Dundee is that it isn't really a well-known Peckinpah film, much like
Correct.
today's film isn't a very well-known Kevin Bacon film. It's
Oh, look at that.
very good segue
Podcasting
there.
gold.
Good segue
What a
there. And of course,
segue.
that film in question that we're covering today is the 1999 supernatural thriller Stir of Echoes. Now, Scott, up until I asked you to guest on this episode, had you heard of the film before?
Yes, and I've seen it before as well. Yes.
Yeah, because I'd seen it, I'd heard about it, but always being mentioned in conjunction with The Sixth Sense. In that The Sixth Sense very much stole this film's thunder because they came out around about the same time in 1999. Stir of Echoes came out a little later. And even critics at the time were saying, whilst this is a really good film, it's a shame that it's coming so soon after a film with a very similar subject matter, in The Sixth Sense, which of course was a box office sensation. And I can kind of see where they're coming from, but I do feel like the way the both films approach the subject matter of a child who speaks to ghosts, it's quite different, I'd say. It's different enough to mark them apart. I don't know what you think.
I would say it is, I would say it's different as well, because because definitely it kind of plays slightly differently. I mean, obviously there's in this film there's a focus on the Kevin Bacon character, and the Kevin Bacon character is kind of the lead. And while the child plays a big part in the movie, it's not as focused on that as the Sixth Sense is. I guess. I mean, because I feel like Haley Joel Osment plays a bigger part in The Sixth Sense than this kid plays in this film, even though he does play a big part. And then, it kind of plays slightly different. I mean, and obviously there's no twist in the same sense as The Sixth Sense in this movie. So it's an interesting film, this film, and I think it does play slightly differently. And even though it is based on a novel from the 50s, just based on kind of 90s horror films, this kind of feels like a kind of cross of The Sixth Sense with Jacob's Ladder, which has like a what which again has which again this movie doesn't really have a twist ending in the same way, but like Jacob's Ladder, the thing that makes me think of Jacob's Ladder is there's a similarly kind of hallucinatory dreamscape shifting sands kind of thing going on, where you're not quite sure what's real, what's not real, and what we're seeing. And obviously in this film it kind of ties up, you're seeing glimpses of things in the Kevin Bacon's character's mind that makes sense by the end of the movie, but when you're watching the narrative unfold, it doesn't make sense in the moment, which is obviously Jacob's Ladder builds up to something different. I mean, I don't know why I'm being coy about a film that's over 35 years old, spoiling the twist of that movie. But if people haven't seen Jacob's Ladder, then they should
Oh, yeah.
definitely check out that movie as well.
Well, there's also
Maybe I should.
there's a similar effect that they use when Kevin Bacon sees the ghost. The ghost has a similar head shaking effect that you see in Jacob's Ladder, and also I feel like the opening scene kind of sets the film's tone about how it handles its horror elements, because you've got the little kid called Jake in the bath, and he's talking away to his imaginary friend whilst his father, Tom, played by Kevin Bacon, is sort of watching over him whilst playing the guitar. And once it comes time for Jake to come out of the bath, we then find out, when Kevin Bacon's left the room, that he's been speaking to a ghost. And I kind of like how the way they play the kid, they don't play him like a creepy child or a particularly haunted child. He's just a very normal toddler who just interacts with ghosts as if it's nothing.
Yeah, that's true. Because there's nothing like, because the kid's supposed to be, I think the kid's supposed to be like maybe like 5 or something. He just talks away to them, like they're just like friends of his or whatever. And yeah, there's nothing like kind of there's they don't play up any kind of spooky or creepy element. Around Jake, the kid character. So no, which is interesting, because it like most films like this would do that, and it does kind of you do kind of at first, I've seen it before, so I kind of knew how it would unfold. Yeah, at first you're not quite sure what's going on, because obviously. Because the kid is just talking away in the bath, and he's talking like kind of directly to the camera as if breaking the fourth wall, but But then you realize he's just it's something off camera that he's talking to, and then obviously yeah we see that it's like there's nothing there, there's nothing visible there to the eye, to the viewer. So it's like, oh, this must be talking to a ghost.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of an interesting twist that it's Kevin Bacon's character of Tom who's more directly affected by the ghosts than, or by the ghost in this sense than his son. And whilst I'd argue it does work, there is a scene later on involving Jake where I do kind of feel like having him be a bit more scared would have maybe made it a bit more effective. But I don't know how hard that is to achieve with a toddler actor. I guess you have to worry about kind of scaring them too much when they're filming this kind of film.
Yeah, well, I did what. Yeah, I mean, like, it seems like they did pretty well. I watched like a little on YouTube that you can see. There's a little 20-minute behind the scenes featurette that must have been ripped from a DVD or something that was put on YouTube, and I watched that, and it seems like the kid actor Zachary David Cope. Who I think was only like 5 or 6 or whatever when the film was made. It seems like he did pretty well, and apparently Kevin Bacon had a discussion with him before the film started filming and said, you know, there's going to be some scenes where it's going to be kind of intense, and I'm going to, you know, sometimes I'm going to act a bit weird, and sometimes I'm going to be shouting very loud, but it's all make believe, it's all pretend kind of thing. And it seemed like talking to him on that level. So it seemed like they were, you know, based on that story from Kevin Bacon, they were pretty good with the kid, and the kid had like a sense of like what they were doing, and it was all just play and make believe, and you know. So I guess that's how you have to deal with kind of child actors, particularly child actors of that age, where they're only, you know, I mean, they're barely primary one kind of age, you know, they're just like, you know, little 5-year-olds kind of thing.
Well, in the next scene, Tom gets more of an unpleasant, realistic surprise as he gets told, and he, as he gets told by his wife Maggie's sister Lisa, that Maggie is pregnant, and this is where we first get a sense of Lisa's psychic sense, and I quite like her as a character because she obviously plays a quite a pivotal role in the story. But yeah, I kind of like that she's got a bit of a spunky personality and she's a bit abrasive, and the way she bounces off Kevin Bacon is really good. She's not like a flat, kind of spooky psychic character. She's this very ordinary woman from Chicago.
Yes. So yeah, I think like that character, the Lisa character played by Elena Douglas, is like probably one. I mean, this is like, I think without her character, actually, that like the film might tip into being maybe a little bit too dour, because it's like it's, you know, it's quite. I mean, obviously, you know, it's a horror film, so you want it to be kind of intense or whatever. But the Lisa character adds like a different flavor and adds like some comedic beats, and she's like this kind of fun, kind of snarky kind of character, is really quite sarcastic and quick-witted, and yeah, I think she really adds something to the film. So no, I really enjoyed Elena Douglas's character as well.
And she also kind of fits into the film's, or she kind of embodies the film's sort of setting, which is very much working class Chicago, because all the characters, including Kevin Bacon, have got noticeable Chicago accents. And it's interesting that this film is rooted in very much a sort of sense of place and setting that you tend not to get so much in horror films now. I guess maybe because they're aiming it more towards, I don't know, an international market, but I find with a lot of American films now, there's a sense for films to be set, if they're not set in a big city, to really have more of a sort of, I don't know, kind of like middle American feel that international audiences can easily understand.
Yeah, that's true. I think like it is a bit more unusual, I think. Because like often kind of like supernatural kind of ghost flicks or whatever happen in more isolated areas, and small towns and villages and places that are out in the country or whatever. And yeah, so to have it in like a kind of urban kind of working class neighborhood is yeah, it's a little bit different to a lot of horror films, I would say. Yeah. So it gives a little bit different flavor. And yes, yeah, I mean it is, and they make good use of that. They could make good use of it being like set in Chicago and everybody, yeah, like you say, doing the kind of Chicago accent. And then like not being American and never having been to America, it sounds kind of all right to me, but I don't know. I would have to refer to people. I know at least one podcaster in Chicago, so like I don't know how accurate it is to the kind of Chicagoans.
So
You know.
if it's anybody from Chicago listening to this, please let us know in any comments section how true this film is to Chicago in relation to the accents. Like, was Kevin Bacon as good? Was Ileana Douglas as good? Just let us know. Another point that I like about the scene as well is that the relationship between Tom and Maggie, where they both are clearly in love with each other to the point where Tom is trying to hide his disappointment at having the couple having another child. But you also get a sense that Tom has had to put his dreams of being an abandoned hold in order to provide for his family. Because again, sort of Maggie sort of says, she tries to apologize for it. She's not wholly dismissive of Tom wanting to carry on with his music career, and Tom's trying to make it sound like it's not a big deal that he's putting his music ambitions on hold, but it clearly is. There's clearly more going on under the surface. He clearly resents having to work as a lineman, and it makes the later scenes where there's more tension between them. It kind of makes it, at least from the character of Maggie's perspective, more ambiguous as to whether Tom's acting the way she is with her because of his psychic abilities are literally driving him mad. Or is it because of that? Or is it because he resents being the provider and having to put his dreams on hold again to be the main provider for their ever-expanding family? So that's an interesting kind of dimension, which they don't dwell on too much, but they include enough of it that it makes an impression.
Yeah, I no, no, I totally agree, and I think like I think that like Kevin Bacon as Tom is really good, is really good, and we had kind of in the build up to recording this, we had kind of talked about it offline a little bit that like I do think this is one of Kevin Bacon's strongest performances. And I do think it's one of his kind of maybe most underrated performances, because it's maybe not as famous as some of his other films, or as iconic as some of his other films.
I think it's because there's so many layers to it as well. I mean, obviously you've got him being the loving family man, but you've also got some slight, he's got an abrasiveness to him, which you get in his interactions with Lisa, particularly in the house party scene that we'll come on to, as well as also portraying the character's aggressiveness when his psychic abilities get unlocked. He's kind of playing on multiple levels, and he never does like the Shining that Jack Nicholson does. He never goes from being like, ticking time bomb to psychopath, or loving family man to psychopath. It's always like quite multi-layered.
No, that's true, and I guess it's quite a different character from Jack Nicholson, because his character in The Shining, because like Jack Nicholson's character in The Shining he's already kind of damaged. If you like, it's a like it's there's. Like the arc of that's just very, very different. I think that like you do get the sense of that he, and even when there is tension between the characters of Maggie and Tom, you do get the sense of like he never like loses himself completely. He never like kind of completely loses his mind or anything. And as much as he kind of like thinks his life sucks, and as much as he kind of obviously feels kind of trapped by the job he's in, and like you know just like he wants, you know, he just doesn't feel like there's enough personal significance in his life. You know, I don't know if he necessarily wants riches, but I think he wants like greater status, or you know, like just a greater, you know, so to do something that he believes is important, wherever that may be, like whether it's his music or whatever, and then this becomes his important thing. But I don't think you ever get a sense of like there's always a baseline sense that he very much is in love with Maggie, and he very much does care a lot about his, you know, his son or whatever. You know, as much as he kind of pulls away from them and like kind of goes into this kind of mission, and is like the mission becomes everything, I think that there is still that sense there that like, so you never kind of turn against them. He never be like, and like you say, you know, it's unlike The Shining, because he never like becomes the villain of the piece or anything like that. Like, yeah, he's kind of goes into this mode of being slightly deranged by this, you know, by this project, you know, that he feels he has to. This is something that's going to make his life mean something in a more important way in his mind. But I think he is still grounded by the fact that he does genuinely love his family. And I think you do always still get a sense of that, even at his most kind of deranged, when, you know, later on in the movie, which we'll talk about.
So the next scene shows Tom, Maggie, and Lisa going to a house party where we meet two important characters. One is a guy, two of Tom's friends, rather. One is a guy called Harry, who Tom's renting his house from. And the other is Frank, if anybody's seen the film Small Soldiers, they'll know him as the dad from that, Kevin Dunn.
The dad from that.
Yeah, because it's just
Crikey.
because
That is.
I was trying to work out when I saw the film recently. I thought, where do I know this guy from? And then I kind of looked him up on IMDb, and I'm like, yeah, the guy from Small Soldiers, the main character's dad, who owns the toy
Yes,
shop in
so
Small Soldiers.
the first thing that the first thing I think of is the character Ben Cafferty, who is in the TV show Veep. And that is what I think of when I think of Kevin Dunn. And then I guess like if you're thinking of like massive hits, like even though I don't like those movies, like he is Shia LaBeouf's dad in the
Oh, the
Transformers
Transformers,
movies.
yeah.
So like, but Kevin Dunn is like one of those actors who's in everything. He's just like, he just pops up all the time in movies. Like, he's just, I don't know, he's just one of those like supporting actor guys, who just pops up again and again. I've seen quite a lot of films with Kevin Dunn in it, you know. Like, I mean, just, you know, just quick rundown. He's in like Mississippi Burning. He's in the Steven Seagal film Marked for Death. He's in Hot Shots. He's in Chaplin. He's in Chain Reaction,
I mean,
the 98 Godzilla movie, Small Soldiers, like you say, Snake
yeah.
Eyes, you know, like you know, Transformers movies, which we talked about. Whole just tons and tons and tons of different things.
And
He's in so much.
he's really good in the role of Frank because he kind of plays the sort of family man character that he plays in, the Transformers and the Small Soldiers films. But there's kind of a darker edge to that character, which we do kind of see in this scene in a kind of comic way just before just before this, the hypnotism scene, where we just see him in
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
where he's leering at a woman, but it also foreshadows what his son ends up doing, which we find out later on, which I thought was a nice bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah. Oh, for sure, for sure. I think that like yeah, 'cause like you kind of get the sense that like yeah, you kind of get the sense that he's like a bit creepy because there's like a later scene when they're going to a football game or whatever where he's kind of making kind of like leering comments and then his wife is talking about him in a way that's like, why are you with this guy? I don't know. Like it just seems totally
Yeah, it's almost like that's the most she could get. But then as the party carries on, Tom gets roped into by Lisa and being hypnotized. I really like how the hypnosis scene is depicted with the old movie theater and the walls turning black and the words kind of sleep appearing on the screen. And later on, we get a kind of a similar dream sequence where Tom's in the movie theater, but he's on like a levitating like couch. It's really unique, and it's apparently the only one of the few things taken from Richard Matheson's novel was apparently the depiction of this hypnosis scene. I just really like how it's done.
Yeah, no, I th I it's a really cool sequence. You know, when she's giving the hypnotic instructions and like you say, yeah, you first kind of see the movie theater and an empty movie theater and then like, you know, the whole movie theater turning black and a kind of black shadow going across the walls and then the seats and then yeah, like and like you say, you know, kind of the word kind of being out of focus on the screen, and then like sleep appearing on the screen. I think yeah, I think the whole thing's done really well. I think it's really effective. I think it does give it a kind of it gives it an extra layer because I guess you know they could have done the hypnotic scene in various different ways, but it definitely gives it a bit extra flair and a bit extra creepiness that I think is, yeah, really effective.
And then once that's over, Tom suddenly gets flashes of images of like a boy waving outside his house and a girl with a plastic bag over her head, causing him to wake up. And again, I like how when they show these images, they just show bits and pieces of it so that you're not getting the full picture until much later on. I feel like a less confident filmmaker would have maybe I'd made these images a bit longer, but I feel like David Koepp does a good job of just keeping it like to quick flashes.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right because, like, you know, I mean, obviously, they want you to kind of play along, you know, and they want you to put you in the shoes of Tom's character and be similarly baffled by these images and try and piece together these images and fragments of things that he receives. Like he is, so you were kind of, you know, so we're not kind of 2 steps ahead, you know, because like, you know, sometimes with these sorts of films and where a character is trying to solve a mystery of something, a supernatural mystery, you know, sometimes the film gives away too much and you end up being ahead of the character. And sometimes that can, you know, sometimes that can work, but often that is not great if you're building up to like a kind of like a twist or a reveal, or something like that. You know, I mean, obviously in horror, you know, sometimes that can work because sometimes you do want to be ahead of the characters in terms of like, oh, we can see the thing, the demon behind them, you know, and the character's not aware yet, you know, and so sometimes like that kind of things would work. But I think with this kind of thing, where you're kind of like following along with the mystery, you want to be kind of at the same speed as the character. I think the film does a good job of keeping you at the same speed as the character, not going too far ahead and being like, oh, well, I know what this fucking shit is, you know, why, let's just wrap it up now.
So when Tom wakes up, Lisa reveals that he's highly susceptible to hypnotism, which doesn't really please him. And it gets even worse later that night when him and Maggie are having sex, and he suddenly gets these flashes again, but this time it's not just the same ones he had before, but he also sees new information. Like he sees a tooth falling out on the floor. He sees a fingernail break on the wooden floor as well. He becomes increasingly sort of agitated during sex, and breaks off from that to go to the bathroom, where, surprisingly, one of his teeth comes out, but it's revealed that that's a hallucination. And I like how, in terms of Tom's visions, they're not just limited to the split second shots he gets during a dream or when he's in a hypnotized state. You also see stuff affecting the real world around him as well. So it's not just like, it doesn't just come, the supernatural visions don't just come in one form. They take many forms, which I think does a good sense of like throwing off the viewer.
Yeah, no, and this cuts back to the kind of like kind of comparing it to Jacob's Ladder, because like, yeah, there's a bunch of scenes where like scenes play out, and it takes you a second or two to be like, oh, is this really happening, or is this like we're kind of in a kind of hallucination state with Tom, and sometimes you're kind of like, oh, this is definitely not happening. But often it does a good job, and this scene particularly does a good job, because like, even when I was watching it, I wasn't quite I was like trying to unravel like what's real, what's not real, because I wasn't even sure. I even at one point even thought the sex with Maggie was like a hallucination as well, but like it's not. The sex of Maggie was happening within the reality of the film, and like so it does kind of keep you on your toes, and you're kind of always trying to be like, is this real? Is this supposed to be really happening in the film, or is this one of the kind of hallucination states? So I think this scene's particularly effective on doing that. I think there's some later scenes where it's kind of more obvious that it's kind of like, no, this definitely isn't happening.
Because
Got you, film.
the slight overuse of CGI kind of cold effects sort of tips you off. But the nightmare isn't over for Tom, as after he goes downstairs, drinks a whole carton of orange juice, he's still haunted by split second images of this figure with something over her face, interrupting his thoughts. He then collapses onto the sofa, and when he leans forward to turn on the TV, he leans back to find a ghostly girl sitting beside him. And then once
Dun
he
dun dun.
and then once he turns around, turns back around to look at her, she's gone. The film doesn't really use jump scares, which is what I like, and this example is a good example of the muted jump scare. But then once Tom kind of decides fuck this and going back upstairs, he then sees Jake at the top of the stairs, who puts his fingers to Tom's head and then calmly tells his dad not to be afraid, revealing that Tom now shares Jake's ability to see ghosts and not yet to communicate with them. But it's also quite creepy that Jake's totally calm about it and his dad is freaking out.
Yeah, well, I mean, it suggests that Jake thinks of this as being totally normal, which, I mean, I guess like I guess it is kind of suggested that like that Jake has kind of always had these powers, and even at the tender age of only like 5 years old, has kind of already kind of semi-mastered them. And like because like we get a character later who says, that Jake is like a greater receive, like, because there's a point in the film where we meet a character and they're kind of referred to as receivers, and it's suggested that Jake is a greater receiver, gets more of an image, that a more full-blooded image than Tom is receiving, who's just receiving kind of scraps and bits and pieces. So I guess he's probably is Cam about, within the reality of the film, it does make sense that he is Cam about it, because like we get the sense that like he's always had these abilities, and he's now pretty, even at five, is pretty good at these abilities.
So the next morning, Tom tries to explain the events of the previous night to Maggie, who tells him to contact Lisa. And Lisa's very kind of casual about the fact that she mentions to Tom that she said something about wanting him to be more open-minded and to receive anything. So she's quite calm about the fact that she's now kind of engineered Tom to receive spiritual messages.
Yeah, no, she's pretty laid back about this, and at first she lies, like, because he's like, I've read up on post-hypnotic suggestion. Did you do that to me? And at first she's like, Nah, I would never do that to you. And he's like, Really? You tell the truth? And then she's like, Yeah, I might have said something. But then she kind of plays it off as like this innocuous thing. I was just like, I just said like be more open-minded or whatever. And and not knowing the kind of impact of that.
I mean, I think if I
Uh,
was
so so
Tom,
so yeah.
I think if I was Tom, I'd be a lot more angry with her than just kind of slightly annoyed like he sounds. I'd be a bit little more, I'd be a little more forceful on the phone, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's just like, yeah, he's grouchy about it, but not like real angry. Yeah, he's and like, but that's his like his kind of, but until like towards the end where he's obviously spiraling a bit, like that's his kind of like, that's kind of what he's like. He's not like really mad about like a lot of these things. He's just kind of, It, and I guess like that's one of the interesting wrinkles of this film is like it is fantastical in a way because we're playing with a ghost story, and I mean obviously some people believe in ghosts, I don't personally, but like whatever, whatever, I can't prove that they don't exist, so like maybe, but anyway, we're dealing with kind of a fantastical realm or whatever, but like the thing I enjoy about Kevin Bacon's character is like he deals with all of this kind of like supernatural weirdness in this kind of like in this kind of gruff blue collar guy way of just being like, oh God, I gotta deal with this shit. And he's not like, he doesn't underplay it, like, because he is concerned about it, but he also doesn't like go completely like kind of like, oh my God, either. It's just kind of like, it's just another thing that to put on his plate kind of thing. And I enjoy that about his character, you know?
I mean, there's a scene later on where he does kind of react like that, like, oh shit, here we go again. And it's
Yeah.
actually really good. It's really nice, sort of a different, it's kind of consistent with how a character like that from that working class background would react without it seeming too comic.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think so. I think this is the like one strand of the story that feels quite grounded. That like this guy is just like quite a like worn down guy. He's got a tough job, and like he works long hours and whatever. And obviously to get them the house they did, and all that, and with the kid, obviously he went through a period where he was working a lot of extra shifts. So he just seems like a kind of like worn down guy who's just trying to get through life, trying to survive, trying to put food on the table for everybody, and for the family and all that. And like this is just like another thing he's got to deal with, and he's like, and he's grouchy about it. And so yeah, I think it plays well to the character.
So that night, Tom and Maggie are going to a baseball game, and when the babysitter for Jake comes to the front door, Tom gets this flashes of red and a buzzing noise can be heard. And again, massive headaches. And these kind of carry on throughout him and Maggie sort of going to the baseball game. All the while the babysitter who Jake suggested to his mum that she get that she hired for him because his mum was having trouble getting a babysitter, and he mentioned, talk to so and so, she'll get so and so to look after me. All the while the babysitter goes upstairs when she hears Jake talking to again the ghost. And then Jake mentions a girl called Samantha. And the babysitter's like, how do you know Samantha? Do you know where she is? And then kidnaps Jake. And all the while, Tom's sort of walking to the baseball game. He's about to go in. He's getting these flashes of red. And then he realizes that Jake's been kidnapped. And he races back to the house, realizes that Jake's gone. And then goes then intuits that the girl's taken Jake to a nearby train station, and so they go in there and they find out that that Samantha was the girl's sister who had gone missing, and the babysitter thinks that Jake knows where she is. That whole scene is just really well done. It's just, again, sort of going into the supernatural, merging into the reality in unexpected ways. With the flashes of the red, we don't know what that signifies or where that's coming from with the buzzing sound until when Kevin Bacon's at the train station and we realise it's coming from a departure sign there. But again, it's just the way it's done. It's quite, almost quite surreal and kind of takes you off guard.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think that I think a lot of what works about this movie comes back to Kevin Bacon, 'cause I do think that the flashing red light thing and the kind of we get this kind of womp kind of sound effect or whatever. I don't know. I think a lot of what makes that scene work, I think, comes down to the way Kevin Bacon's reacting to it. 'Cause I don't know, I think in other hands, that might have, it's possible. There's a few scenes I thought about this in the movie where I thought if another actor was playing this, or they're playing it kind of goofy, they're playing it kind of more heightened or whatever. There's a bunch of stuff in this movie that could come off as way more goofy
Oh,
than
yeah.
it actually does. And actually watching the film. And I think I kind of came down on a lot of that is down to Kevin Bacon's performance and the way he's reacting to things, and he doesn't kind of he doesn't under or overreact. He just reacts at this kind of perfect level that kind of it keeps
Yeah.
you kind of engrossed and keeps you kind of with the film. Even when it goes into goofier territory, the thing of for some reason the hallucinations make him real thirsty, and he becomes addicted to orange juice, which is one of the weirder kind of side strands of the movie, but it still works. And anyway, so I think it's similar with this scene, because I think that this could have come off goofier, the whole flashing red light thing, in other hands. I don't know.
But another scene, a scene though where Kevin Bacon doesn't come off as goofy is the next scene. Where Tom and Maggie are questioning Jake about how he knows Samantha. And this is the only time, interestingly enough, that this happens. Samantha, I guess, briefly possesses Jake because he says, don't ask the boy questions, talk to me, in a really deep voice that implies that Samantha's possessing him. That never comes up again, but Tom immediately starts kind of getting freaked out about it and starts trying to get Jake to talk to him in the voice again. And the way Bacon plays it, where he goes from just being excited about it to getting increasingly aggressive to the point where he's really yelling at this kid actor's face, is pretty intense. And it's like, I kind of feel like, in a way, Bacon, although he plays it, he keeps it coolish or realish for most of the film. There are parts where he's the scariest thing in the film, because where he's losing his temper or where he's genuinely acting insane, and it's quite unsettling to watch.
Yeah, for sure, because there is a sense of like there is the odd moment in the film where it seems like he's been kind of driven completely over the edge or whatever, and he each time he manages to kind of come back from it a bit, but like yeah, this is definitely one of them where like he's going quite crazy. The other thing I wanted to mention about this scene is like the interesting thing, like one of the things that I kind of like rewatching the movie that I was reminded of and that I kind of thought was like kind of interesting and maybe somewhere there's like a longer cut in the movie, like they don't do much with this subplot, like they kind of the whole kind of like Samantha's family and like obviously we get this scene and Debbie taking Jake and then like accusing Tom and Maggie of having something to do with like with the disappearance of Samantha. And you do think like that that's going to lead to some sort of subplot that like maybe like Debbie's kind of hounding them or like trying to stir foment against them or
I'm
something. But
kind of
anyway,
glad
like
that
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 never really
didn't.
comes to. I know what you mean. Like I guess like it makes it more of a streamlined movie and
Yeah,
it
and more
doesn't it
focused,
do,
yeah.
doesn't do. It makes it a more focused movie because it's a focused movie. It's only like 1 hour and 35 minutes. So like, and you maybe need to make it like a 2 hour movie to accommodate like a subplot like that.
Well,
I don't know, but
I'm
like, but
kind of
it's
glad they
interesting
didn't,
that they
though.
throw that up and then they don't really do anything with
Well, I
it.
mean, I think to be fair, once to be fair, I think that the daughter Debbie is being a bit kind of irrational when she's accusing them, and
Sure.
so I think that would be shut down pretty quickly. Also, I kind of like the fact that this film is quite streamlined as it is, because later on, there's stuff to do with like a group of psychics, and whilst part of me wishes that the film would expand on that, part of me, the other part of me, is kind of glad that the film is quite streamlined, because as it is, the film is, as you said, only about 1 hour 39 minutes, and I feel like if this film was made today, that whole psychic bit and the bit with Debbie's family, with Samantha's family, would be expanded into subplots, and the film would be like 20 to 30 minutes longer, and it would just be too overstuffed to feel.
For sure. I know what you mean. And then like the actual central plot could be kind of overwhelmed. And it could become more of a jumble. So no, I'm not complaining about them not expanding on it, but I just think it is
Yeah.
interesting to kind of like I kind of understand just having like the kind of psychic thing,
Yeah.
as like I kind of understand having the kind of psychic group thing as like a sprinkling. That's kind of like Catherine
Yeah.
Erb doing that is kind of like the equivalent of like Jessica Harper and
Okay.
Suspiria going to visit Udo Kier, and
Oh,
then
sure.
Udo
Yeah.
Kier gives an exposition dump on witches,
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
like cool Udo Kier, we'll not see you again, like you've done your job, and I think like the character the kind of other psychic policeman character who comes in, I kind of like, yeah, I got him as being like he all right, he's just an exposition dump character to kind of give a little bit more on kind of like what are these psychics about? That's fine. But I do think it's more unusual to bring up like what is going to look like a more substantial subplot
All right.
with Debbie and then just entirely drop it.
All right, okay.
I'm not mad that they dropped it, but I just felt like
Yeah.
I just felt like it's a bit different. Like it's a bit different. It does feel like there's going to be more meat in the bone there. Whereas the psychic group stuff, it does feel just like a sprinkling, it never felt like it was going to go into a full subplot. Like you say, if it was made today, probably there would be like a whole kind of Stirs of Echoes mythology and like the long line of receivers and and it would be like 2 hours and 15 minutes or whatever,
So a week later, they're at a block party, and Maggie tells Lisa that she's been worried about Tom. He's not been out in a week. He's been acting weird, not been going to work. And Lisa is at first sarcastic but sympathetic. She tells Maggie that, she should seek help from somebody else. And then Tom turns up and starts asking, like Harry and his other friends, what he knows about Samantha, who's clearly the ghost that Tom's been seeing. And he then finds out that she ran away 6 months ago. And but however, Harry then denies that Samantha died in the house, which is something that will come up later on. And also another interesting point is that Maggie then says that it's like Tom and Jake have their own secret language, that they're obviously that so they've obviously been communicating to each other psychically, which we don't really see on screen.
Yeah, no, we that's all kind of done off screen. And I like the point you make about like Lisa being like sarcastic than sympathetic, because one of the things I like about the script of this film is that the relationships are quite realistic. Some of them are like quite tense, and some of them are like obviously the relationship with Lisa and Tom, they don't really like each other because they live in very different worlds and they just have a very different worldview and they kind of clash, but like they don't hate each other. And nobody kind of like is like unnecessarily antagonistic. They're just like kind of a bit shitty with each other in a way that people can be, which I think it is a real strength of the script and the film and the character relationships.
Because that's how normal human beings are, they have their ups and their downs. Because I feel like there's a lesser version of this script where Lisa is completely antagonistic towards Tom and tells Maggie to stay away from him or something, or words to that effect. She becomes more of an antagonistic force towards Tom. But that never happens.
Yeah,
She says.
or Tom totally hates her, and they hate each other from the start, and they have like this real kind of like hate fueled relationship where it's not that. It's just they just don't understand each other, and they're just very different people. But they kind of like through their joint love of Maggie, like kind of like put up with each other, and like even have like a kind of banter with each other as well, and kind of have a sneaking like of the other as well, but while also being on these kind of two totally different planes. So yeah, it's interesting. It's more kind of layered that way.
So the next day, Tom wakes up and it seems like a normal day. He's about to go out and then he sees Frank, a very worried Frank, who warns him that both him and Maggie are going to be killed by somebody. And Tom asks Frank why, gets no answer. He then decides to go round to Frank's house just to see if there's somebody else there to work out what's up with him. And so when he goes into Frank's house, he sees his son Adam with who shows him one of Frank's guns. And before Tom knows it, Adam shot himself, which leads to Tom immediately waking up. And initially he thinks it's all a dream, but then he realizes he's doing the same thing as he did in the dream, checking under his bed. And this is the moment I was talking about earlier. Kevin Bacon does a really good crap realization when he realizes, whoops, his dream is actually his psychic vision of what's going to happen.
No, he does a real good job of this. This is definitely one of the scenes that it's more obvious that we're not in reality. Not initially when he's trying to find his boot the first time, but like when when Frank comes out of fucking nowhere, and then he's kind of wandering around, and then like Frank acts in this kind of odd, slightly kind of medicated way, and like so you kind of I think you have like a stronger sense of like, oh, this is like a hallucination or a vision or something.
And
But yeah,
also
no,
it
I think
kind
Kevin
of
Bacon does a good job.
and also it kind of what it kind of follows in line with what this with what I really like about this film is that the psychic visions don't really follow any particular set pattern because this takes the place of a realistic dream. Sometimes it's just like a certain motif, a certain color will flash up. It's not like, say, something like The Sixth Sense, where you know, the visions Haley Joel Osment has of the ghosts tends to follow kind of a similar pattern. Here, there's no real particular rhythm. It feels more dreamlike, and it almost like feels more erratic, which kind of catches you off guard.
And I think obviously that's like a very deliberate choice. Like you know, again, watching the behind the scenes, you know, David Koepp was kind of like he wanted to do things in as kind of many as many ways as possible to kind of to get the kind of creep in the atmosphere and the scares. You know, he was like he's doing a mixture of things. So like, you know, he's got like a couple of jump scares, but not too many jump scares. He's got a couple of things that are just kind of like put you on the wrong foot that they're supposed to kind of like unsettle you in a kind of atmospheric kind of creepy way. He's got a couple of gross out moments because we get the moment with the teeth pull, and then we get the kind of that the mental flash of like the broken ripped off nail. So you've got a couple of gross out moments. So I think that I mean it's from listening to the behind the scenes, it seems like that was a very deliberate choice that he wanted to try and you know, get as many different angle, you know, because everybody kind of scares differently or you know, things freak them out differently. And some people are more kind of it responds stronger to gross out moments. Some people respond stronger to, you know, jump scares or whatever it is. So it looks like that was a very deliberate choice to try and, you know, mix it up constantly throughout the movie. So we're looking at horror in these different angles.
So, Tom then races to Frank's house because he realizes that his vision's becoming a reality, only to break in and find out that Adam's already shot himself. And when he gets taken away to hospital, Maggie decides to take Jake out for a walk, and they both end up visiting a cemetery. And when and they realize inside the cemetery that they're interrupting a police funeral. And one of the police officers starts to follow them. And when Maggie asks him if everything's okay, he reveals that one, he's psychic. He's the leader of the psychic group that we talked about earlier. And that he knows that Jake's psychic as well as Tom. And he tells Maggie to get Tom to visit him. And as he's leaving, Jake reveals that he knows the guy's name, which is Neil. This whole psychic thing with Neil and the psychics, that kind of never. I feel like if this film was made today, that whole bit would be fleshed out a lot more.
There'd definitely be more kind of there would definitely be more to this, and we would get like a backstory to the psychic group, and we'd get like yeah the or you know we maybe get like a subplot where like Jake visiting the psychic group or something and learning about the history of receivers or they would definitely be fleshed out more. Which I mean could work, but then also, like you said, could like drag, you know, could
It would
work
kind of
as
it
like
would,
an interesting subplot,
yeah.
but also could just like drag down like the, you know, the pacing of the movie. So like it could go either way.
So later on that night, Maggie visits Neil's place, and again, we just see a couple of groups of psychics in the background. We don't even see them inside the apartment where Neil lives in. We just see them in the background. Neil then takes Maggie outside, explains that after his hypnotism session, Tom, as well as Jake, are now both receivers, and that they can't control what they're seeing, but that some have stronger flashlights, is the term he uses, than others. Jake clearly has a stronger connection to the ghosts than Tom does, and Neil also says that the ghost that Tom is seeing, i.e. Samantha, clearly wants him to do something for her. And unless Tom does this thing, he'll be haunted by her forever. And again, it's all kind of nicely contained exposition, all within this brief, like 3 to 4 minute scene. I feel like if this film was made today, this would be like a whole big 20-minute long chunk, and it would just eat into the screen time.
But I do like, I agree. I agree, and it's good that it's just this kind of sprinkling rather than like a whole chunk of the movie. And I don't think that what like, we haven't really mentioned Catherine Erb as Maggie. Like she's good in this movie.
Oh,
Like
yeah.
I because I think like because again. I think, like in a worse version of this movie, she would be like a kind of nothing character, and
Oh,
she'd
yeah.
just be standing on the sidelines as her husband goes mad. But she's not. She's like a proactive character, you know. Like she's, you know, she's trying to be supportive, but is also like at the same time kind of fed up of him and his mission. And then obviously, like later on. Kind of like feels insulted because like you know like it you know it, she because he you know says about the kind of being trapped in his life and his life being stupid or whatever and then she kind of takes it as like well you know what's that say about me like you know you're denigrating me as well in that not just your job or whatever so like and I think like there is something to this character, and I think like Catherine Erb's performance is pretty good. And I have to say, like I've not seen like a lot of films with Catherine Erb. I mainly know her as like Law and Order Criminal Intense Catherine Erb. But now she's pretty good in this. She's pretty good in this.
So when Maggie gets back, we've got a scene where Samantha affects the three of them, as we've got Tom, who's playing his guitar constantly because he's trying to remember a song he keeps hearing in his head, and he's trying to play it on his guitar. And Jake's watching a film on TV. A strange choice of film for a 5-year-old, isn't it? One of the Hammer Horror Mummy films.
Yeah, apparently it's re like yes, I think there's a thing throughout the film where it seems like the kid is like really into monster movies, but like Maggie is constantly telling them not to watch the monster movies because like and turn them off or whatever because like it gives them nightmares and like he doesn't you know and then they have to come to her you know or whatever. So like but yes obviously Tom at this time is distracted and is not paying attention but like yes that is one of the kind of mini subplots of the movie or mini threads of the movie that like the kids are really into monster movies
And a,
but very much doesn't want to watch Night of the Living Dead as we
oh
find
no, oh
out
yeah,
later.
as we find out, because Maggie changes the channel over to a kids show, but then Samantha then starts popping up in the on the set of the TV show, and I like the effect that they use to like digitally superimpose the actress playing Samantha onto the 70s kids TV show. I think that's very good. And then Samantha takes over the TV and starts changing the channel to Night of the Living Dead, as you said, again to tip Jake off about the murder. He keeps trying to about her murder, or her death rather, spoiler alert, her death. Jake keeps trying to change the channel, but Samantha's ghost won't let him. He then unplugs the TV, but it won't turn off. My only complaint is that the way the child actor's been directed, Jake seems a little more annoyed. I feel like he's then scared. I feel like he should be getting slightly more scared by this happening.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is true, but yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. Like it seems like more emotionally true to for him to be like more kind of terrified by this than just kind of like a bit upset. But you know, obviously it's very difficult. This would have been very early acting appearance for this child,
Oh, yeah.
and I guess it must be hard to be directing a child that young. Because, like
Yeah,
I
I
say, I
mean,
think he was only
you.
like five. So,
Yeah.
like you know, I mean, that's a very young
Yeah.
child, just starting school. So, like, yeah, I don't know. Like it's difficult. It's difficult because yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, you probably do want a bigger reaction out of that character, but then kind of stepping back into the reality of like filming the film, like I don't know. Yeah, it must be kind of difficult to kind of direct a 5-year-old and yeah, in that way. And for a 5-year-old to give like a kind of like what we'd view as like an emotionally true performance in that moment, you know, like because like you know it's you know like it's a 5-year-old, you know, they wouldn't act, like it's so yeah, it's interesting.
And meanwhile, Tom, however, is still trying to is raiding his music collection to try and work out what the song is, when he suddenly gets plunged into another vision, which I really like. It's his house, but it's all kind of got the windows are all boarded up with plastic, everything's covered in plastic, and he sees a figure at the door that's Samantha. And I really like the way ghost Samantha moves towards him. It's like this weird stop motion-y movement. I don't know how they achieved it, but it's very
Yeah, I don't
creepy.
know.
And
Yeah, I guess it is. Maybe they've been watching some of those Japanese ghost films.
yeah,
Like
probably, because she does
it
move.
does like it doesn't have any of that creepy clicking of Japanese ghost horror
Oh
movies,
no, oh
folks.
no. But
But
it's very.
it does have a similar effect to those
And
kind of
it
ones.
and it and it's the breath is both of Tom and Samantha is both frosted over, so it's like they're in this frozen netherworld. And Samantha starts controlling Tom's hand, and we then see a concussed Maggie, because she's gone down. She's actually suffering the least out of all the family. Basically, Samantha makes her bath water cold, so she goes down to the basement to sort out the heating, and Samantha switches off the light bulb in there, so she briefly knocks herself, hurts her head on the basement ceiling. She gets it easy.
I mean, she was bleeding from her hands, so she
Ah,
could have a
yeah.
concussion.
All
I
right. But that gets quickly glossed over as
mean,
she.
yeah. I mean, like, obviously, it's 1999. Nobody knows about CTE at
Yeah,
that time, you know. Like,
absolutely.
so it's fine. It's fine, you
But
know.
it's not stopping her from entering Tom's hallucination, or vision
No.
rather, to snap him out of it. And the image of where she walks into the sitting room and sees Kevin Bacon sort of standing there with his arm contorted and his face kind of contorted is really creepy. I mean, the film doesn't ever get outwardly scary, but in those moments
No.
it gets really creepy.
No, it gets creepy. Yeah, like it's kind of like on that level. It's kind of like it's an interesting kind of super. It's a very good like kind of supernatural kind of drama. But like as on like a horror scale, like the scares are kind of they're creepy, but they're kind of light scares. And
Yeah.
particularly if you've watched a lot of horror, you probably wouldn't find this like scary at all. And also I think like the thing that I would say that I would flag up for like maybe more modern viewers or younger viewers. Like I think another thing that kind of stops the film being scary is like, and this is just like one of those things that it can't change because it was made when it was made, But this is like a kind of Hollywood horror that has like a kind of 90s slickness to it that I think provides kind of like a barrier to like being like kind of really scared by it. And I think particularly for kind of more modern audiences or maybe used to like Hereditary or whatever, you know, like I think there is a kind of like that there are more kind of I don't know, jagged edged, you know, or kind of, I think that there's a kind of, yeah, there's a 90s gloss to this that I think might dampen down the scares for a lot of people, particularly more modern, younger horror viewers.
So the next day, or the next night rather, Tom's at Lisa's flat and asks her to hypnotize him again. And when she puts him under, he's back in the cinema, but the darkened cinema. But this time he sees Samantha sitting in front of him and the words dig forming on the screen and more shots of somebody being murdered, starting to look increasingly visible that it's Samantha. And what I find interesting about this scene is that we find out that Lisa's bisexual.
Yeah, right. Which is like what I find interesting about that is not the fact that she's bisexual. It's the fact that this was a movie that was made in 1999, and like it's not commented upon. It's just like he walks in, he doesn't go like, "What's this woman doing here?" Nothing's made of it. It's just like, "Oh, right, you've got to go now. We've had our fun getting stoned. I know this is not the plan, but like you got to go now." And like I think that's the more kind of thing that stands out, that like there's nothing made of it. Whereas in most movies of that time, if a character was gay or bisexual or or queer in any way, then that would be like central to their character, and that would have to be like a defining aspect of their character, or maybe the only aspect of their character. Whereas here, it's just like, yeah, it's whatever, and we're moving on with the rest of the plot, which that's what I found most interesting about this, given when it was made.
I mean, particularly compared to something like, say, The Haunting, where Catherine Zeta-Jones's bisexuality is very much played up as like a sexual kink, and it's meant to exoticize her kind of as a character, whereas here the character of Lisa, it's just very normal.
Yeah, and it's just played as kind of like, yeah, this is a thing that's happening, and this date's been spoiled now. That's annoying, and like that's all it is. And like nobody, there's no comment on it, and there's no clearly, presumably, Tom knows this, that she swings both ways or whatever, and that's it. And that's cool. And I like that, and I think that it's a kind of like little progressive beat. Particularly for, like I say, for a movie made at that time, where in most other movies made at that time, a much bigger deal would have been made out of that. And it's cool that it's just like a normal everyday thing that you're like, cool, that's who she is. Perfect.
And so the next day, Maggie comes home to find massive holes in the backyard being dug by Tom and Jake. And this is actually one of the more unhinged moments that Kevin Bacon has, where again he comes across, I think, is quite scary in a human way. Where Maggie's sort of telling him to stop digging for what he's searching for, and he blows up at her and attacks their life as a couple. And it's because he's not just sort of, and he's saying that this search for what happened to Samantha is the most important thing in his life, because it's not only sort of him losing his mind because of his psychic abilities, because of what Samantha's giving him, but it's also him taking out his frustration at where his life's going on Maggie. It's almost like a very real fear that somebody in a relationship would have, that your partner suddenly is frustrated and starts taking it out on you in an abusive way.
And I think again, watching the behind the scenes, it all seems like that's very deliberate. I think I think it was Catherine Erb it was talking about how she had conversations with David Koepp, and like David Koepp was like essentially views this as like a kind of midlife crisis movie. This is character of a certain age. He's probably around 40-ish, and he's like reflecting on his life, and he's dissatisfied with what he sees in terms of, and I think like his insulting of like my read of the character is his insulting of Maggie is actually kind of unintentional, because he doesn't realize by reducing by reducing his life in that way that he's reducing her, like her life too, and looking down on her life too. But yeah, I
Which
think
is
he's
what
just
she
so
uses as a
self-absorbed,
counterpoint.
and yeah, I think he's so self-obsessed and self-absorbed in that moment that like I don't think he's really meaning to do that, but like he is, but he is. That is what that is what he's doing. And I kind of. Yeah, I like the kind of read that this is essentially like a midlife crisis movie is what it is, as well as the kind of supernatural mystery. This is a guy, he got this supernatural moment, and which was a trigger for a kind of full-blown midlife crisis, but it could have been triggered by something else, which is why this movie is kind of a horror movie, but is also like essentially kind of like this more kind of family drama at the same time.
Absolutely. So inside, back inside the house, Maggie gets a phone call from her brother telling her that her grandmother's dead, and then she realizes that Tom had foreseen what had happened to her grandmother beforehand. She obviously wants both of them to go to the funeral, but Tom doesn't because of his obsessive search for what has happened to Samantha and how is it linked to the visions he's having. So this causes Maggie to storm off with Jake. And then Tom goes out, buys the biggest drill possible, and goes nuts drilling a hole in the basement whilst laughing his head off.
That's true. And so like and this is, I mean, this is the real moment where you kind of like go off Tom a bit, and like he, because he is acting like a kind of asshole during this section of the movie, and you're entirely on Maggie's side, and like it's kind of like, sure, this is important, but like her grand just died, and obviously her grandma was very important in her life, and so you're like the Tom has gone off the deep end at this stage. However, I would say this is one of the things I was talking about earlier. This whole digging section of the movie, which for some reason was like my main memory of the movie, like from it, the first time watch, like that's the thing that I retained the most, the digging section. This whole section of the movie could be terrible. Like in a like there's definitely a worse movie version of this, where it's not handled as well by the director.
Where the tone goes completely off.
It's massively overacted by the actor. Like this could be like where the movie completely loses the plot and devolves into like just silliness. And yet, as a kind of absurd as the digging section is, it never tips into being like, this has just got stupid and I'm turned off now. And I think a mixture of like Kep's direction and like Kevin Bacon's performance, which is heightened but still kind of grounded, I
And
think like means that you never turn off the movie.
I think also Kep knows when to cut the digging section short. Like I think if there'd been a long montage of Bacon digging away, then it would have been kind of insufferable. You'd be like, okay, this isn't going anywhere. But instead, we kind of intercut this with, I think, the aftermath where he's talking to Maggie at his at her grand's funeral and saying, "Look, I'm sorry, I've stopped digging." And then we get this whole stuff where she wants to go back to the house. He's saying no. Jake doesn't want to go with her because he's had a vision of feathers that he finds dangerous. And then we go back to, again, Tom trying to dig again. Instead of it just being like one big section, like 10 minutes of the film devoted to just Kevin Bacon trying and failing to dig, which would have completely, thrown us off course. But what happens is that whilst Tom is hammering away at the basement floor, he accidentally dislodges part of the nearby wall. He then starts pulling away at more of the bricks of the wall out of curiosity, dislodges them, and then pulls away a bit of plastic sheeting to reveal Samantha's body, revealing she was murdered. And then we get Tom touching Samantha's hand and getting the full flashback of her murder, which reveals that she was lured to Tom's house back when it was being done up by Harry, by Harry's son Kurt and Frank's son Adam, under the pretenses that they want to show us something, and they attempt to rape her. And the scene is really horrific and harrowing, but it's not gratuitous, and yeah, it's just really well shot.
Yeah, no, it's a nasty sequence, but like you say, it's harrowing, but not in any way kind of sensationalized. So I think, yeah, that's good. And yeah, I mean, like Adam's, Adam is like his role in the scene, I guess, is more he is part of the accidental murder of this poor girl. I mean, he is obviously like just an absolute rotten coward, because while he doesn't get involved in the sexual assault, he very much just stands on the sidelines and doesn't say or do anything, like an absolute bastard. And then he ends up, being part of like murdering her. So even though you kind of have more hate for Kurt in the sequence as it happens, I mean, Adam is kind of just as despicable, because like he's done, well, at first he's done nothing, and then when he did do something, he it was part of this fucking murder. So they're both despicable. And then yes, and then obviously we get the reveal that like the parents knew but covered it up because they didn't want to derail their two sons' football careers, basically.
And we also find out that the song that Tom was listening to in his head was playing during Samantha's murder, and it was painted black, but for some reason not the original version.
Presumably that's just because they couldn't afford it. I mean, like, it's just like these kind of music rights like are quite often quite expensive. It's why you don't generally hear like Beatles songs in movies. It's because they're just too expensive to stick in there. So I presume that's a kind of like the production couldn't afford the original version. Because I was surprised when it was a cover as well, but I don't know what the budget for this movie is,
It
but I
wasn't
just presumed that obviously they didn't have the budget
wasn't
for it.
large. It was only 12 million.
12 million. Okay, fair enough. Probably that, with all the effects and stuff like that, I think probably they just they by the time they got to the kind of music syncing, it was just like, oh, we don't have much of a budget left for that, like we've spent it all on all these kind of cold effects and stuff,
So in the basement, Tom reveals to Frank, who is brought round, that he knows about Samantha's murder by Adam and Kurt. And then Frank breaks down, and Kevin Dunn's really good in this scene. He said that he had no choice but to help cover it up because he was worried about the boys' futures. And yeah, Kevin Dunn's great in it. And then he tells Tom to go he then tells Tom to go upstairs as he pulls out a gun, and you initially think that Frank's shot himself, much like father like son, or like son like father, rather out of shame. But then at the front door, Tom then goes to find Harry and Frank, who don't want to turn themselves in, or do themselves in, rather. They instead want to.
Harry and Kurt.
Yeah, Harry and Kurt, sorry, did I say Harry and Frank? Sorry. Yeah,
Yeah.
Harry and Kurt want to try and silence Tom. But then after kind of a short action scene, and after a short action scene, it looks like they're about to pull it off. Particularly as Maggie's pulled up and she's got to the house and she gets caught up by Harry and Kurt as well. So Harry and Kurt are about to kill both Tom and Maggie when Frank turns up. Turns out he's not killed himself and shoots both Harry and Kurt. And as Harry gets shot, he fires upwards, his gun upwards, and the bullet goes through the floorboards, through the bed, and through one of the pillows in, I think, Jake's room, causing feathers
Yep,
to fall down.
it's Jake's room, which is a night, which is a cool moment, because it's like, oh yeah, okay, so that's like we got our little
It
bit of
also
foreshadowing, and yeah.
Ties in about how the psychic signals that people like Tom and Jake receive, it can actually vary in terms of strength, because sometimes you can get quite crystal clear visions, but then like Jake, you just get the sense, you just get feathers falling and a sense of danger, and that's it. So it kind of
Yeah.
ties in nicely into that earlier moment that, old Jake really gets a sense of in terms of Harry getting shot, his feathers falling, and that's it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And so Frank's obviously devastated by what's happened so far. He kind of breaks down in the doorstep, saying that this is a decent neighborhood, again echoing what he said earlier on. And we see Samantha's ghost walking down the road, and fading away, her business having resolved. But then the next scene, we see Tom, Maggie, and Jake driving off, moving away from the house. But, and this is an interesting twist, all throughout the film, Jake's been happy with the visions that the what he's the signals he's been receiving from ghosts. But as we see him, as we see the family driving past the various houses, we can see him getting overwhelmed by the voices he's hearing from other ghosts, and he starts to cover his ears. So either he's going to end up like Haley Joel Osment, or there's going to be a lot of therapy bills in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Because like, I guess we're getting the sense that the kind of like the receiver, the receiver in his mind is getting stronger, and then he's hearing more and more of these presences. So it is an interest, because it does look like we're getting this happy ending. We see the ghost of Samantha, wandering out the house and putting her jacket back on, and then kind of wandering down this kind of like sun-dappled street, and then Maggie and Tom, like at the moving van, as they kind of hold hands across the moving van and stuff like that, in this very touching kind of romantic moment, and then we drive off, and it seems like we're ending on a very kind of happy, uplifting moment, and then we just get this one last creepy beat of just all these overlapping voices going, Jake, 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 and it's yeah, it works, it works well, and yeah, so like, and I think it's a cool way to end the movie, as a kind of a nice like one last kind of creepy moment. And
What
it's
we,
interesting because, sorry,
but
go ahead.
I was going to ask you, what were your thoughts? What are your final thoughts on Stir of Echoes?
My final thoughts. I think this is a really It's not the scariest ghost story. So like if that's kind of your bag, if you're looking for something that's really gonna like, you're gonna have to leave the lights on, or whatever, like this probably isn't it. But it does have some fun, effective, kind of creepy moments. And as like a character study, it's great. I think it's a really good film. I think it's got one of Kevin Bacon's best performances. I think all of the supporting cast is really good. I think that it's very easy for a child character to be annoying or overact or whatever. But this kid is like solid. I think the supporting cast is really good as well. I think Kevin Dunn is great as like this character who's initially kind of just seems like a sleaze ball, but then later we find that he's more rounded. I mean, he's still done terrible things, but like he in his mind is a, feels like he's doing the right thing. I mean, we see that kind of conflict, and I think Kevin Dunn's character, his performance was really good. I think I really like Catherine Erb. I think like outside of Kevin Bacon, Alana Douglas is probably the second runner up MVP of the movie.
Oh
Because like
yeah,
Lisa
she's
adds
great.
Lisa adds a lot of color to this
Yeah,
movie.
she does.
She's definitely the most fun character in the movie, and it's nice it has that strand. So yeah, I think like it's a solid ghost story and a really good kind of character study. So yeah, I just think I think it's a really underrated film. I think it's got more appreciation nowadays than it did back in the day because it was overshadowed. It was overshadowed by The Sixth Sense, but I think maybe overwhelmed also by
Yeah.
like it came out in 99, which is
Blair
like a lot
Witch.
of people, a lot of people rank as one of the best movie years, and there's just so many great movies from 99 that a lot of things get kind of lost in the mix. I think this is one of them. But yeah, I'm glad that I think more people appreciate it now. And yeah, I just think it was a really good movie.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good note to end the episode of Stir of Echoes. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk. Always happy to talk movies, particularly horror movies or action movies or whatever. So it's great. So whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, I'm happy to talk about them. So thanks very much for having me on again.
Yeah, and keep an ear out for the episode I recorded with Scott on Major Dundee, which is going to be out in late February, I think.
Yes, it'll be out, yeah, kind of like towards the very end of February. So yes, so look out for that, like the end of February. Both my podcasts will come out in the last week of February. There'll be the latest episode of All 90s Action All the Time, where we're going to be covering the Anna Nicole Smith
Oh.
Die Hard ripoff Skyscraper.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
yeah, and then Major Dundee with Adam, which I'm sure you'd be all very excited about listening to this podcast.
Films That Time Forgot is available on all good podcast platforms, so Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, you name it. However, if you want early access to episodes, please subscribe to my Patreon. That's Forney Film Reviews. That's Thorny Film Reviews. And join us next episode where we'll be covering the Samuel L. Jackson and Kevin Spacey, there's a dream team for you, action thriller The Negotiator. And
Oh, yeah.
until next time, keep watching.